Hello, Mzanzi. You are listening to Farmers Inside Track, proudly brought to you by Food for Mzanzi. Officially, this is the world's best podcast for 2024, as awarded by One IFRA, the global organization for the world's press. I'm your host, Duncan Masua, and welcome to this episode powered by CropLife South Africa. Now, in this episode, we explore the transformative potential of genome-edited crops and their benefits for small-scale farmers. Now, this discussion features industry experts Chantal Arendse, who is the plant biotechnology lead at CropLife South Africa, as well as Dr. Hedy Groenewald, executive manager at Biosafety South Africa. We investigate how innovative agricultural technologies can boost productivity, resilience, and sustainability in farming practices. These experts also discuss effective strategies for communicating agricultural science to enhance understanding and acceptance within local communities. Chantal, Dr. Hemi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you for the invite.
It's a conversation that we've featured a lot in the recent months on Food for Mzanzi, as well as our sister publication, Health for Mzanzi. Chantal, you've sort of touched on it in a previous discussion. Maybe we'll get Dr. Hedy to kickstart us on this conversation. Maybe explain what genome editing is to start and how it differs from traditional genetic modification.
Hi, Duncan.
Genome editing, actually, the meaning is captured in those two words. Genome, in the first place, refers to the genetic material that's within a cell or within an organism, and editing just like you would edit words or a document, and a Word document or something like that, it means you can change the letters. So what this means in terms of genetics is that it's tools that we can use to change. As most people know, you know, our genetic code is written only in four letters, A, G, T's, and C's. But the particular sequence in which those are present in your genome has a direct impact on your genetic traits. So this is actually the basis of evolution and the diversity that we see around us. You know, you can talk about things like breeds of dogs or, you know, different, if you plant crops, for example, the different cultivars of maize that we get. The differences that we see in these cultivars or in the breeds are because of these specific changes in the sequences. So it's a long story to get to the point to say is if we now understand how that differences in the genetic makeup relates to the traits that we have, we can use that information to design and then change genetic materials to get the traits that we want in things like agricultural crops, for example.
So you have genome-edited crops on the one end, and then you will have conventional crops on the other end. Maybe take us through what the specific benefits are of genome-edited crops and what they offer to small-scale farmers compared to conventional crops, of course.
Perfect. Just remember that I didn't answer the second part of your question, is how did genome editing differ from genetic modification like we define it? And in the South African context, of course, these definitions can vary a little bit between different countries in the world. But generally, genetic modifications refer to when we take a gene from a different organism and put it into crop. BT maize that most people have heard of, for example, the BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacterium. If you transfer the gene to the crop, you've done genetic modification. So just to clarify then, where I said earlier, we changed the sequence of the DNA code. It means with genome editing, you change the existing traits in a plant versus genetic modification where you bring something in. Then to get to the benefits can, of course, be a very long discussion. And I hope that you can see from how I introduce genome editing is that it's the value is based within the genetic material. In other words, in biodiversity, actually. So when we talk about, you ask the question specifically, what's the benefits for small-scale farmers? So we mustn't think, you know, that there's a technology that kind of have some benefits and then we're going to share it between different role players or something like that. As we talk about genetics, we talk about genetic diversity and the traits associated with it. So the question that we should look at is to say, small-scale farmers, what do they need that those traits that can be based in genetics? And then we go back to the crops and say, can we engineer this into crops? If I think of small-scale farmers, for example, as something like drought tolerance or insect resistance, if you are a small-scale farmer, you only plant a small piece of maize, when, you know, there's an insect pest, for example, that comes and eats up your whole crop, it's going to have a huge impact on you because you're going to lose basically most of your crop. So I would then think something like insect resistance would be a benefit to small-scale farmers. So now I can go back to the plant and I say, oh, but over the years, you know, we've bred lots of different crops, cultivars. Some of them are more resistant than others. And then I go and try and, you know, research this mechanism. Why is the one crop more resistant than the other one? If it has a genetic underlay, I can use that knowledge to go back to one that's not resistant, for example, and then I can make it resistant. So the point I want to make is, in the first place, you know, it depends on what a specific group of people want. You spoke about small-scale farmers. We can go back, you know, one who consumers want, for example. We can use genetic engineering or genome editing to introduce traits that consumers would benefit directly from, something like more nutritional foods, things like that. I think broadly, one of the terms that I like, and it's obviously a loaded term, but it can mean so many different things. And this is what I would like, you know, your listeners to think about is, what does the word sustainability? What does sustainability mean? We can do sustainability through genome editing, like I explained, you know, either using less herbicides, for example, or insecticides, more nutrition, because then we have nutritional security, all those type of things. So sustainability, all different type of stakeholders, small-scale farmers, commercial farmers, consumer, whatever we can think of.
So the benefits are, I suppose, you know, widely documented. But with that, Chantal, there's a lot of misconceptions, I suppose, that come with genome editing and people's understanding of it. Maybe take us through that. What are the main misconceptions about genome editing that you believe need to be addressed in public discourse?
You know, the misconception is probably associated with the word new, because we sometimes refer to genome editing tools also as new breeding techniques. And I think the biggest thing there is to understand, very importantly, that genome editing techniques are grounded in the same principles of plant breeding. And so it's a tool that is used as part of that plant breeding continuum. And so we use the tool essentially to achieve the same outcomes that we would for traditional plant breeding. The difference being here that the tool is more efficient. It can achieve those outcomes more faster. You know, you don't have to go through a whole series of plant breeding cycles that take years and years to eventually end up with a plant or a variety that has the specific trait that you're looking for. It's just, I think, important that it is a continuation of the plant breeding process, which has a history of safe use. So I think that would be the main, I think, misconception. And of course, as with any, I think, new innovation, it's important that consumers and the general public need to be sensitized about it, to understand the facts and also to know where to go, where the credible sources are of information. When we turn to popular media, I would say, the first thing that captures us is not necessarily the facts. And so I think that that is very important, that we need to turn to credible sources of media and information.
What can then be done to foster trust amongst farmers and consumers?
Well, exactly what we are doing here, trying to dispel those myths and trying to bring facts to consumers. And I know that communication, I would say, is key. It's not always easy because, you know, science is very technical. Genome editing is very technical. I mean, we have a hard time here just trying to break it down so that the average person in the street can understand what we mean by it. But I think that, you know, there are various roles to play by people who are in the know and to try and bring those key messages across and just to broaden public understanding. And this would be important, you know, especially if the technology is to be taken up. We need that societal acceptance as well. And so I think, yes, communication is one of those things that could help to build those trust factor amongst the general population.
Eddie Chantal talks about science being quite technical and, you know, genome editing also being very technical. In your view, how can scientists and agricultural professionals, I suppose, better communicate the benefits and safety of genome edited crops to the public?
I think the first point that I wanted to make is touch on something that Chantal said. Communication is a complicated issue in the modern context. And I think this is actually the challenge. People, we all are guilty of this. You know, when you look at something specific with the accessibility of information, most people now use social media to get the information, for example. And I don't just talk about, you know, the old guys use Facebook and the younger people tweet or X or what, all of those different things. But just in general, you know, even if you go to a website and you read and whatever, it's very accessible. But the problem is that we all look at the information through our own perception glasses. Most people actually go to the internet to try and look for information that confirm their beliefs. They don't go and look for the facts. And this is one of our big challenges. So saying that, you ask specifically the question, how scientists and people in agriculture can communicate about this. So I will focus on that first. So I would say my first point, I've got 3 points, I think, that I would like to touch on. The first one is to say, continue to participate. Don't just think, you know, it's other people's job, especially people that are on research. You know, I always joke and say the reason why we are scientists, you know, is also because we have a particular personalities and things. I didn't go into molecular biology because I love to tell jokes to people. So we are by nature not very communicative people. So you can get frustrated. And just to give you an example, you know, if we talk about the safety of GMOs and things like that, today, it's more than 30 years later, I still hear the same questions that I heard 30 years ago. So if you get frustrated, people will immediately shoot you down. Nobody's going to listen to you because they're going to think you're arrogant or whatever else they want to do. So my first plea is participate in this discussion. Don't get discouraged, because every time that that person asks me the question, although it's the 10,000th time that I heard the question, it's the first time that that person asked the question. So it's important to not get discouraged and frustrated, continue and participate. Then the second plea that I would have is to say people must go and read a little bit about science communication, just the basics. I mean, there's very nice YouTube videos like Cinetech and those people that say, you know, what are the principles of communication? How do you communicate more effectively? Don't start with these stories of complicated genetics and whatever that you forced me to do today. But, you know, that we talk about, why do we do this? There's a reason behind it. If people just sit a little bit and think, but listen, this guy actually wants to have an impact on sustainability in the world. You know, not just sustainability of agriculture and let farmers make more money and all these nonsense stories that you hear. We really want to leave the world in a better place than we got it before. Even the scientists, the point I want to make is that why are we doing this? What are the benefits and those kind of things? And then the last point that I want to talk about is that in the end of the day, you know, we can sit and talk about these things forever. And some people that listen to us now, for example, some of them will say, oh, that's interesting. Let's go and have a look at whatever. Other people are going to sit there and judge immediately and say, oh, yeah, yeah, that guy is just speaking for the big companies, or he's this or he's that, and I don't like him for whatever reason. But the point is, in the end of the day, I think the best communication that we would be able to do from the scientists and the agricultural perspective is to develop products that speak for themselves. The day that a person can go to the market or to the shop and pick a tomato that's got higher vitamin A or vitamin B or whatever, and it's labeled there to say, you know, it's designed to be better for you, or it's designed to be better for the environment and whatever, then people will have practical experience. So one of the points that I didn't touch, but I think one of the big issues in this whole discussion is that we hear about risks, and we hear about benefits. This is part of our everyday lives. When you get into your car and drive somewhere today, there's risks and there's benefits. The way that you perceive those risks are influenced by a multitude of things that we can talk about for the whole day. But the point is, you've got experience and you've done it a lot of times. So your risk is reduced in your mind and the benefits are increased, because it's much quicker to go to the shop by car than to walk there. So the point that I want to make is, we've heard about these GMOs or whatever, and unfortunately, most of the ones that are on the market were designed to benefit farmers more, because remember, it's about agronomy. It's higher production or whatever, for good reasons, because we need food security and all of those things. But the benefit is not directly translated to the consumer in a clear way. It did have benefits for the consumers, you know, because we produce more food prices, even though you know that food prices is a big issue all over the world currently. But the bottom line, without those technologies, it would have been much worse, because we would have produced less. Long story to say is, you know, the biggest communication, I think, will come from the products. And genome editing gives us that opportunity, because it's a technology that's easier, more effective, more precise, and cheaper to implement than something like genetic modification.
Chantel, maybe you want to come in there, you know, from a CropLife South Africa perspective, what have been your experience in communicating genome editing and the benefits thereof? Is there challenges in that, or does there seem to be a keen interest and uptick in it?
there's always going to be a challenge because of that. Unfortunately, the link in South Africa between genome edited and GMOs. This is because of the way the regulatory system has evolved and the decisions made around how it should be regulated. But I think from a CropLife South Africa perspective, it's a challenge, but it's a challenge that we take up. Yes, it's important because as Henny mentioned, you know, previous innovations have delivered products specifically focused on the producer. And I think just the versatility of genome editing tools lends itself to applications or products that resonate with consumers. Just this issue of what the shared value system. So things that are important for consumers. He mentioned sustainability. He mentioned the health conscious consumer. Those that are not environmentally conscious, that don't like food to go to waste. So these are all the types of applications that the tool can be used to develop, you know, in terms of products. And so, yes, correctly. So we do focus more on the benefits because it's relatable to consumers. But unfortunately, yes, that stigma of GMOs is always lurking there in the background. And so it's for us to try and make sure that there's that differentiation. But it's a challenge we continue, I think, to take up, and especially in a platform such as this, where we speak to Food for Mzansi to try and clarify for the public.
Now, of course, there's, you know, apart from the research and development side, there's also a regulatory framework. What is the current regulatory framework in South Africa when it comes to genome edited crops?
Regulation can also be a complex issue to discuss. So I'm going to try and only focus on a few things. I think the first thing that we have to say about regulation, why do we regulate things? It's to manage risk. You know, the person that prepares your food in a restaurant or in a cafe, a takeaway or whatever, when you drive your car, again, you need a license, all those things. We reduce the risks by regulation and making sure that there's things. So just like that, the food that we produced are regulated. And it's been regulated forever in terms of the food safety aspects. You can't just go and plant something and then put it on the market. We must make sure it's safe. So food products and agriculture is subject to a lot of regulation. All of those regulations are still applicable to when you do genome editing or genetic modification. But in addition to those regulations, we decided when people started doing genetic modifications, because there's a specific risk. Again, we don't have time to talk about why those risks are there, but there's specific new risk context that I refer to always. And because of that, we said we should regulate them in addition, and we created in South Africa what we call the GMO Act. And those risks that we regulate specifically refer to food safety, the environmental safety, and then the socioeconomic viability of the product. So again, those things are not new. They've been regulated, like I just explained, by other regulations as well. But now on top, specifically in terms of this genetic modification context, we regulate them under the Act as well. So Chantal also referred to that. This is the history. So we have a GMO Act. Now we come up with a new technology. That technology produces different types of products. You remember my very first question, I answered later my second one. You say, what is the difference between genetic engineering or genetic modification and genome editing? In GM, you will remember we put in genes from other species, but in genome editing, we just changed the genetic material that also happens naturally, the basis of evolution, actually. So the question first, because this is still a technology, the first question in people's minds was, so are these GMOs or not? So this was a discussion all over the world. Most of the countries in the world decided, no, they are not equivalent to genetic modification, and we will regulate them in a different way. We will regulate them, in fact, like conventional ones, more or less. But in South Africa, in October 2021, our regulator published a notice to say, based on their interpretation of the definition in the Act, they think genome editing is regulated as GMOs. So at the moment, we see genome editing still, and it's regulated as GMOs, but there is still some flux in the system, and we will see where this ends up. The point that I think is a little bit more important is that you ask, how do this ensure safety? So the GMO Act specifically put in place two things. In the first place, it put minimum standards there to say, if you make a GMO, you know, it should adhere to these and these minimum requirements for food safety, environment, and the socioeconomic viability, like I said earlier. The second thing that it put in place was the infrastructure to ensure this. So the GMO Act, for example, is one of very few acts that is actually spread over different government departments. There's, in fact, seven different government departments involved in this system. So it's not only agriculture or science and innovation that says, let's innovate and see where we end up with. Department of Health is there, Department of Environmental Affairs, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody ensures the safety. And in addition to that system, in terms of the government systems, there's also scientists, which they call the Scientific Advisory Committee, that actually does a technical risk assessment of the product. So this is the most important point probably that I got to make. People always hear about the theoretical risks associated with GMOs, for example. We understand, we know that these are potential risks, and this is why we put regulation in place to manage those risks. What you should distinguish from or between is this: we have these theoretical risks, then we have a regulatory system through which we put the product. So in the end of the day, when the product comes out on the other side, you can't just talk about the theoretical risk. This is a product that's gone through the process to ensure it's safe. So a product on the market, it will not go to the market if it's not safe. So the developers, the government, and scientists play together to ensure that those products are safe. This is exactly the same as comparing, for example, if you travel at high speed and you're in an accident, you can be seriously injured because you didn't have brakes, you didn't wear your seatbelt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the end of the day, you still do it. You do it in a safe way because you adhere to all of these prescriptions. So it's two completely different things that we talk about. So the point I want to make is the foods, we only have three crops, in fact, in South Africa that's commercialized. That's GMO, for example. They are safe because we put a system in place to ensure that they're safe, not just in South Africa. This is repeated in every country across the globe.
Thank you for sharing that. And I suppose that's a topic that requires its own sort of discussion when it comes to regulation. And what does that mean? Is it an advantage that genome-edited crops still fall under GMOs when it comes to regulation, or is it not? But perhaps a conversation for a different time. Chantal, I'm going to have you wrap up the conversation for us. But Henny, maybe just your thoughts on how you see the future of genome editing evolving in agriculture. And then Chantal will also then wrap that question up for us.
Before I go there, just quickly, something that you said. I remember what I referred to now, the safety system for GMOs, because there's a specific new risk context. Again, I hope it's clear to say that when we spoke about genome editing, the point that I wanted to highlight is that that risk context is not the same because it's based on the genetic changes that we make. When you put in a new gene from a different species, it's quite different from changing the DNA in a way that occurs naturally as well. So I spoke about the regulation where you have the conventional old regulation that looked at all of these things, and then we put GMO on top of that, was for that particular risk context. My argument would be is because we have that different context that's the same as the conventional, we should only regulate it conventionally, genome editing specifically. And then just quickly answering, where do I see this benefit? Again, I would like to start with the beneficiaries. So I would like to see, for example, let's start right at the top or the end of the value chain, is consumers that have more choice, that have more diversity. Because this technology is easier to implement, it also means now it's viable to do that in locally relevant crops. You know, we can use South African, local African crops and improve them to go to the plate. Nutrition, we spoke about all of those things. So the consumers are going to benefit. I would love to see, I've got a very big heart for agriculture. I would like to see agriculture becoming more sustainable because of the traits that we're going to use, you know, to reduce our dependence on chemicals, for example. So it's more sustainable. And I want to see farmers being more profitable because farming must be profitable. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Remember, it's a person that's responsible for producing food for a lot of people that's sitting in the cities like you and I. So I want to see them profitable. And if I go down the benefit to the developers of the technology, I think one of the big potentials is that we see those developers, you know, small, medium companies, the history of the countries that implemented these things early on, you can already see it. You know, it's small companies, it's local companies, innovators, people coming from university. We need that economic growth at that level as well. So I like to see genome editing, a tool that we can use that benefits everybody across society. That's the bottom line.
Chantal, Henny talks about, you know, wanting to see benefits for the consumer, growth, and I suppose innovation of the agricultural sector in South Africa, and of course, farmer profitability increasing when using genome editing. Where do you see this going in the future? What are some of the low-hanging fruits that you believe should be addressed?
It should be part of the future of agriculture. I think going forward, agriculture is not going to become easier. It's going to become harder with all of the climate change, the difficulty in growing conditions. So we're going to need all of the tools at our disposal to even just get to the finish line, wherever that is, because it keeps moving. But in order for that to happen, you know, the technology is there, but its uptake and its adoption by farmers, unfortunately, will be also to a large extent determined by how it is regulated, how receptive that regulatory system is to recognize this innovation and differentiate it from previous GMOs. In parts of the world where they have made this differentiation, there is increased investment, you know, in the innovation and the tools to actually research and deliver products that provide home-based solutions. And this doesn't even escape Africa. I mean, even in Africa, if we look just to the north, there are, as Henny mentioned, it's not just maize, soybean, cotton. It is indigenous crops that this technology is being used on and is taking advantage of. So just in terms of farmers, so yes, it increases the ability of farmers then to just farm with varieties that are suited to their local conditions, suited to address some of their local challenges in terms of pests and diseases and growing conditions that they deal with. And so I think that there is a future for the technology. I think we can't afford to ignore it. We don't have the luxury of time to be picky and choosy. We need to use all those tools in the toolbox. But like I said, everybody has a role to play to make sure that it doesn't just remain a pipe dream, that it actually translates into products that are needed on the ground, whether it's products for farmers, whether it's products for consumers.
Thank you so much for joining us, Chantal Arendse and Dr. Henny Groenewald. You can, of course, read more on this topic by visiting www.foodfromzanzi.co.za. And that's a wrap. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform so you never miss any of the episodes. But for now, from me, Duncan Masiwa, our technical producer, Megan van der Vind, and the rest of hashtag Team Food from Zanzi, thanks for listening.